Almost a year and a half ago, I referenced the following event in a sermon, but the focus was entirely different. I tell you that because I don't want you thinking I'm preaching the same lesson. 11:39 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, January 28, 1986, a day that will live on in infamy for some people. Many Americans remember where they were, in fact, on that day when they heard the news. It's when the Space Shuttle Challenger disaster occurred, when the NASA Space Shuttle Orbiter Challenger broke apart 73 seconds into its flight. All seven of the crew members died instantly. The spacecraft disintegrated over the Atlantic Ocean off the coast of Cape Canaveral, Florida. At first, there was a little flame that simply didn't belong. And then all of a sudden, there was a fireball which seemed instantly to be all that there was of this sophisticated aircraft. In the days immediately following the event, there was a lot of discussion about the scientific, political, economic, military, social significance of this tragedy. NASA suspended all shuttle flights pending investigation of the disaster. The Presidential Commission on the Space Shuttle Challenger accident, also known as the Rogers Commission, was formed to investigate the disaster. The commission worked for several months and published a report of its findings. And then the U.S. House Committee on Science and Technology also conducted hearings. And finally, on October 29th of 1986, the committee released its own report on the Challenger accident. They said, quote, NASA managers had known since 1977 that the design of the SRBs, that's solid rocket boosters, contained a potentially catastrophic flaw in the O-rings, but they had failed to address this problem properly. And so the commission placed immediate blame on a faulty O-ring seal located between segments on one of the solid fuel booster rockets. In part due to cold weather and buffeting winds during launch, the seal allowed flames to attack the main liquid fuel tank and also a linking strut, and the booster's upper end swung into the main tank. The whole assembly burned almost explosively. As of the end of 2010, the space agency had spent more than $192 billion on all the space shuttle programs since its inception in 1971. A final tally of the program's lifetime cost puts the price tag at $1.5 billion per flight. Hundreds of thousands of man hours, seven lives lost, and $1.5 billion up in smoke due to a piece of equipment that costs a few measly bucks. We tend to overlook and even downplay the little things, but life is made up of little things. And little things are important in the eyes of God. We have a lot of sayings about little things. Laura Ingalls Wilder, some of you may be familiar with that name, said, "I am beginning to learn that it is the sweet, simple things of life which are the real ones after all." Author Mary Ann Kelty said, "Small kindnesses, small courtesies, small considerations habitually practiced in our social intercourse give a greater charm to the character than the display of great talents and accomplishments." Dante Alighieri, Dante's Inferno, said, "A mighty flame follows a tiny spark." Vincent van Gogh, well-known individual, "Great things are done by a series of small things brought together." And one we've probably all heard, it's the little things in life that matter. attributed to a lady by the name of Elizabeth Dunphy. The Bible sets forth some interesting examples of little things, some of them bad, some of them good. There are some small things that can be quite harmful. Consider the infraction of eating a piece of fruit. Familiar with the account in Genesis chapter 3, forbidden to Adam and Eve was eating of this particular tree, the fruit of this one tree in the garden. They partook of the tree, and we understand what happened as a result of that. Cast out of the garden, separated from God. Horrific consequence to just a seemingly small, terribly insignificant act. In Numbers chapter 20, verses 8 through 12, we're told about Moses hitting a rock instead of speaking to the rock. In a situation where the children of Israel were in the wilderness, without water, the Lord instructs, "Take the staff, you and your brother Aaron, gather the assembly together, speak to that rock before their eyes, and it will pour out its water. You will bring water out of the rock for the community so they and their livestock can drink." So Moses took the staff from the Lord's presence, just as he had commanded him. He and Aaron gathered the assembly together in front of the rock, and Moses said to them, "Listen, you rebels, must we bring you water out of this rock?" Then Moses raised his arm and struck the rock twice with his staff. Water gushed out, and the community and their livestock drank. But the Lord said to Moses and Aaron, "Because you did not trust me enough to honor me as holy in the sight of the Israelites, you will not bring this community into the land that I give them." What difference really did it make whether you spoke to the rock or you hit the rock? Moses was not allowed to enter the land of Canaan because of this small thing, this tiny error. How big of an issue was it over where Nadab and Abihu got their fire? You know the account, Leviticus chapter 10, verse 1. "Nadab and Abihu, the sons of Aaron, each took his censer, put fire in it, put incense on it, offered profane fire before the Lord, which he had not commanded them." Small act, seemingly. You get the fire here, get the fire there. It's fire. What's the difference? Verse 2 tells us, "Fire went out from the Lord and devoured them, and they died before the Lord. Moses said to Aaron, 'This is what the Lord spoke, saying, by those who come near me, I must be regarded as holy, and before all the people, I must be glorified.' So Aaron held his peace." Joshua chapter 7 gives us record of a man by the name of Achan, ready to take the city of Jericho in the previous chapter, and we're given instructions about what to do and what not to do. Achan sees a beautiful Babylonian garment, sees 200 shekels of silver, which comes out to 5 pounds, weights and so forth, get a little squirrely sometimes, costs and all that, depending on time and so forth. But 200 shekels of silver, a wedge of gold weighing 50 shekels. Rough estimate, let's say that the silver is worth $2,000 today, $2,500. Make it $30,000, it doesn't matter that much. The gold, whatever, $25,000, $50,000. It's not millions of dollars. Insignificant in the sense of not an overwhelming amount of money here. But God had forbidden Israel to take the spoils of these people. In chapter 6, verses 18 through 19, he said, "Keep away from the devoted things so you will not bring about your own destruction by taking any of them. Otherwise, you will make the camp of Israel liable to destruction and bring trouble on it. All the silver and gold and the articles of bronze and iron are sacred to the Lord, and must go into his treasury. Again, seems like a small thing. But in chapter 7 and verse 5, we read, about 3,000 went up. They decided to go up against the city of Ai and said, let's just send a couple of thousand men up. So about 3,000 men went up, and this is after the event of Achan stealing these items. But they were routed by the men of Ai, small city, who killed about 36 of them. They chased the Israelites from the city gate as far as the stone quarries and struck them down on the slopes. At this time, the hearts of the people melted in fear and became like water. 36 innocent warriors, men who had families, died because of this small act, if you will, this stealing. Achan and his family eventually lost their lives because of this. Then we consider the tongue, well-known passage. James chapter 3, verses 5 and 6 tells us the tongue is a small part of the body, but it makes great boasts. Consider what a great forest is set on fire by a small spark. The tongue also is a fire, a world of evil among the parts of the body. It corrupts the whole body, sets the whole course of one's life on fire, and is itself set on fire by hell. You can rip someone to shreds without leaving the comfort of your own recliner or whatever you might prefer to sit in and lounge around in. Destroy someone's life with a very tiny instrument, the tongue. How a person uses their tongue may seem an insignificant thing. Well, I didn't say that much. It's not a big deal. I've heard people say worse. I was only joking. He who jokes confesses is a, can't remember what nationality, what country it comes from, an Italian proverb or something. Read decades ago, and quite an interesting thought. Jesus said, however, that the tongue reveals what's in one's heart. Matthew 12, 34, you brood of vipers, how can you who are evil say anything good? For the mouth speaks what the heart is full of. Great harm can come from very small things. Then there are some little things that are good. Mary anointed the feet of Jesus, given the record of that in Matthew chapter 26, verses 6 through 13. We're told that it was Mary in John's gospel, but this account says, when Jesus was in Bethany at the house of Simon the leper, a woman came to him, having an alabaster flask of very costly fragrant oil, she poured it on his head as he sat at the table. When his disciples saw it, they were indignant, saying, to what purpose is this waste? This fragrant oil might have been sold for much and given to the poor. But when Jesus was aware of it, he said to them, why do you trouble the woman? She has done a good work for me. You have the poor with you always, but me you do not have always. For in pouring this fragrant oil on my body, she did it for my burial. Assuredly, I say to you, wherever this gospel is preached in the whole world, what this woman has done will also be told as a memorial to her. This was a significant amount of money, don't get me wrong. A year's wage, roughly. But still, it's interesting you compare it with the acts, for example, the sacrifices of somebody like the Apostle Paul. Read about some of the things that are stated about Paul. Paul is asking those who are making accusation that he is not truly an apostle. He said, are these people servants of Christ? He says, I'm out of my mind to talk like this. What I'm getting ready to say, he says, I've worked much harder, been imprisoned more frequently, been flogged more severely, been exposed to death again and again. 5 times I received from the Jews the 40 lashes minus one, 33 times, I'm sorry, I was beaten with rods. Once I was pelted with stones. 3 times I was shipwrecked. I spent a night and a day in the open sea. I've been constantly on the move. I've been in dangers from rivers, dangers from bandits, from fellow Jews, from Gentiles in the city and the country, danger at sea, danger from false believers. I've labored and toiled and often gone without sleep. I've known hunger and thirst and have often gone without food. I have been cold and naked. Say, well, those are very significant acts, it seems. Very great sacrifices. And yet we have these other records. For example, in Matthew chapter 12, the account of the widow giving two mites, which I understand is like worth less than a few pennies, worth a 64 of a denarius, which is a day's wage. And if you calculate that, that comes out to about 7-8 minutes worth of pay. Mark chapter 12 gives the record of that, verses 41 through 44. We're told Jesus sat down opposite the place where the offerings were put and watched the crowd putting their money into the temple treasury. Many rich people threw in large amounts, but a poor widow came and put in two very small copper coins worth only a few cents. Calling his disciples to him, Jesus said, "Truly I tell you, this poor widow has put more into the treasury than all the others. They all gave out of their wealth, but she out of her poverty put in everything, all she had to live on." I wonder how many other people there would have been impressed by this widow's gift, this tiny, insignificant gift. God doesn't see as man sees. God looks at the heart. Jesus said in Luke 18, verses 9 through 14, speaking to some who were confident in their own righteousness and looked down on everyone else, he told this parable. He said, "Two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee, the other a tax collector. The Pharisee stood by himself and prayed, 'God, I thank you, I'm not like other people, robbers, evildoers, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week, I give a tithe of all I get.' But the tax collector stood at a distance, he would not even look up to heaven, but he beat his breast and said, 'God, have mercy on me, a sinner.' I tell you," Jesus says, "that this man, rather than the other, went home justified before God. For all those who exalt themselves will be humbled. Those who humble themselves will be exalted." Any good deeds that the tax collector had done were not even mentioned. Probably were so insignificant. And yet, Jesus says that this man went down to his home justified. Pale in contrast to the impressive resume from the Pharisee. Well, what is in this for us? We need to realize how significant the small things are. Typically, small things become big things. There would be no theft without the avarice, the greed preceding that. There would be no adultery without the initial tiny little moments of lust. There would be no murder without those little sparks of hate swelling up in the heart. All the major apostasies began with some seemingly insignificant deviation, elevating one elder, for example, above others and giving him a unique title. As time transpires, led to the hierarchy of what became known as the Catholic Church, elevation of the Pope. An airplane flying several thousand miles gets off course by the smallest fraction of a degree. Doesn't sound like much, does it? But over that distance, it could be perhaps a few hundred miles off course. even when it seems that it won't matter, even when it seems that no one will notice, even when it seems that no one will care, that no one will know, it still matters. We get used to being satisfied with these small errors, these tiny little deviations, and before we know it, they become the norm. Doesn't sound like a real name, but I believe it is. Samuel Smiles. I don't know if he does or not, but he wrote the following. He said, "Sow a thought, reap an act. Sow an act, reap a habit. Sow a habit, reap a character. Sow a character and reap a destiny." But it just started with a little thought. The thought leads to an act. The act leads to a habit. The habit leads to a character. And the next thing you know, you've got your destiny set in stone. Be such things as the way that we dress, places we choose to go, the way we talk to one another in our homes, the way we talk about other people, the way we handle stressful situations. Once we start allowing ourselves to be satisfied with less than what God would expect, these small things have become big things. We tend to devalue, we tend to undermine small things to such an extent that many times we may decide that we're not even going to do something because we can't do it big. Does this thinking not affect, for example, our evangelistic efforts? We have the responsibility to try to teach others, and that responsibility is not just laid at the feet of the elders or the preachers or Bible class teachers. I'm not questioning anybody's motives, but I sometimes wonder if all efforts at large-scale evangelism, let's all do this major outreach here, this mass attempt, if they're not simply subconscious attempts to assuage our guilt for not doing more to reach the lost on an individual basis. Let's do this big thing. Let's storm the community. And then for the next 5 years, we can say, well, we tried that. Somebody wrote a little poem that emphasizes this point. Have to be familiar with the Bible somewhat to recognize these names, but I'm assuming that. Still get the point even if you don't know the names. Shamgar had an ox goad. David had a sling. Samson had a jawbone. Rahab had a string. Mary had an ointment. Some ointment. Aaron had a rod. Dorcas had a needle. All were used for God. What are some little things that we can do? We can focus on one person that we know who's not a Christian, for example. A friend, a coworker, a relative. Pray for them daily. Pray for yourself. Look for opportunities to talk to them about God. Talk to them about the Bible. Invite them to services. If you don't feel confident in conducting a study with them, ask them if they'd be willing to study with your preacher. I'd be more than glad to do that. I realize, however, that that can sound quite daunting, intimidating, unsettling. I'm going to bring my preacher over here, and he's going to study with you. There's an alternative. There are numerous members here who are quite capable of teaching the lost and more than willing to do so. You can talk to one of them and say, if I set up a study with a friend, with a coworker, with a neighbor, with a fellow student, would you be willing to come over and study the Bible with them? Focus on one person. a non-Christian, perhaps even a Christian who needs help, who may be struggling in some way more than you are. Pray about them. Devote yourself to serving them in some way. Fact is, we live in a very narcissistic, self-absorbed culture. Being self-centered is much too easy for all of us. We need to stop being so selfish. We need to stop being so self-absorbed, self-obsessed, so materialistic, so wrapped up in gratifying ourselves with recreational entertainment of all kinds. Steeped in thinking, like many in the religious world, that just because we don't smoke, drink, cuss, and fornicate, and because we attend services 2 to 3 times weekly, that we can be just as given to clean carnality as the rest of the world and think that God is pleased with us. Consider the judgment scene in Matthew chapter 25, verses 41 through 46. Several verses previous to that, the people were welcomed into future bliss because of having done small things. In this section, it's just the opposite. He will say to those on his left, "Depart from me, you who are cursed, into the eternal fire prepared for the devil and his angels. I was hungry, you gave me nothing to eat. I was thirsty, you gave me nothing to drink. I was a stranger, you did not invite me in. I needed clothes, you did not clothe me. I was sick and in prison, you did not look after me." They will answer, "Lord, when did we see you hungry or thirsty, a stranger, or needed clothes, or sick or in prison, and did not help you?" He'll say, "Truly I tell you, whatever you did not do for one of the least of these, you did not do for me." Then they will go away to eternal punishment, but the righteous to eternal life. We must learn not to underestimate the damage of small things that are bad, and not to undermine the benefit of small things that are good. These small things reveal deeper issues. Not helping others that he described there. Lack of concern. Deeper issue of lack of compassion, lack of love, lack of proper priorities. The following illustration is obviously dated. Horses were the main means of transportation. But it said, "For lack of a nail, the horseshoe was lost. For lack of a horseshoe, the horse was lost. For lack of a horse, the rider was lost. For lack of a rider, the message was lost. For lack of the message, the battle was lost." Maybe thousands of men, the effects on their families, a nation, all because of a horseshoe nail worth pennies. Let's never underestimate the power of little things. We're going to stand together and sing at this time. If you need to come forward, we invite you to do so.